This is the James Breslow Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome back to the second hour of the James Breslow Show on TNT Radio. If you want to look me up, you can go to Facebook, Google, etc., James Breslow. Check out my Hidden Truth Show podcast. Check out my writings on Fox News and on Epic Times. And of course, you can also listen to any of my prior interviews on TNT by just going to the TNT app on your phone or on your computer, and all of the prior interviews are posted on there as podcasts. Our guest this hour is Dr. Galen McCullough. He's the author of Tomorrow in America, The Battle for the Souls of Our Children. He is a great man in many respects, which I will get to in a second because I want him to tell us about how great he is, but included playing football for the great Bear Bryant in Alabama. He was an academic All-American there. Can't wait to begin my discussion with Dr. McCullough. Before we get to that, my take on the news: our district attorney here in Los Angeles is back in the news, as he is pretty much every week, as one disgusting criminal activity takes place after another that could have been prevented. This time, it was the killing of two Los Angeles County police officers by an individual who was out on probation, thanks to our district attorney, George Gascon. George Gascon came from San Francisco. He was basically run out of town there because of his leftist law enforcement policies. Actually left there early to run for LA DA. People in LA were not paying attention. George Soros was funding his election. And he defeated the sitting female black DA by a wide margin with Soros money. And now we're trying to get rid of Gascon just the way San Francisco got rid of Gascon. Gascon in San Francisco was replaced by Chesa Boudin. Chesa Boudin was elected with Soros money. He's now been just recalled as DA in San Francisco. He'll be replaced in a vote in November. Guess whose money will be involved in that vote? Will people in San Francisco choose another leftist prosecutor to replace the past one? It wouldn't surprise me if they actually re-elected Chesa Boudin, because it's my understanding that even though he was recalled, there's nothing that prevents him from running again in November. People in Los Angeles are working on their own recall of George Gascon. Let me tell you what his response is to the fact that this guy had been convicted of a felony yet was out on probation. That's the way Gascon works. It's no bail. You get arrested, you're back on the street the next day. Reduced sentences, probation whenever possible, early releases whenever possible. For sure, the biggest problem in LA as far as crime is the fact that the criminals are not in jail. They're out on the street. But this will give you an idea of his response to that. He added that prosecutors must continue to work toward a safer community. Good idea. How? These are prosecutors, by the way. People whose job it is to put people in jail. Here's how the prosecutors should continue to work toward a safer community. By doing things we know that work, including interventions for those on probation, transitional services for those getting out of prison to keep them out of prison, trauma recovery, working employment and housing services, and so on. So, no change regarding early releases, no change regarding probation instead of prison, no change as far as letting people out on bail. It's just a bunch of leftist gobbledygook. Because it all comes from the foundational premise that our criminal justice system is racist, built upon white supremacy, and the only reason that we have minorities committing crimes is due to racism, not personal responsibility, not problems in those communities, not problems back at home, again, with the failure of so many homes to have a loving father and a loving mother in the home. That's my take on TNT Radio.
Delivering the facts.
Source I can trust.
Today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Okay, I'm super excited to introduce my next guest who came to me by way of the East Coast and our mutual friend Johanna, who's delivered some fabulous people to me. I've met some great people through her, so a shout out to her. I'm not even going to say her last name because she says she doesn't like to use last name. She's only known as Johanna. But Dr. Galen McCullough, welcome to the show, and I'm glad we have a mutual friend.
And thank you so much. I'm really honored to be on your show. Johanna's had a lot of very nice things to say about you, and I've really been looking forward to this.
Good. So I could read your bio. It's a mile long, and in each paragraph more impressive than the prior, but we'll just start that says, well, first of all, you're a major doctor slash plastic surgeon in Alabama with a huge practice, I understand. And I noticed when I was looking you up that you've did an interview with the guys from Botched, which is, if people pay attention to plastic surgery at all, they know about Botched, which is the big show on, I think it's the E Network. I've had a friend actually who's been on Botched as a botch-e, as opposed to a botcher.
Dr. Nassif, Paul Nassif.
But anyway,
Dr. Nassif and I have been good friends for a long, long time. And when my book, The Gift You Give Yourself, came out, Paul openly wanted to endorse the book, and we had a nice interview, and he had some very nice things to say about the book. But he's done a wonderful job on that show, and I think what it's done is it's made people aware of the fact that plastic surgery is real surgery, and you need to do your research and make sure that the person that you choose to do your surgery or your procedure is qualified and has done many, many, many of them, and that you aren't one of his or her first patients in their practice. So I think Paul's show has done a really good job of making that point.
Yeah, well, you know, when it comes to elective plastic surgery, I am an outspoken critic, not on the radio, but just mostly with my wife, because it just seems to me that so many people come out of elective procedures from Botox to actual surgeries, always feeling like they did too much or too little, and they're still not necessarily feeling better. So that's my concern with it. I'm sure you see that
we could talk about this for an hour sometime, because I've been in practice now almost 50 years, and I have a little different take on this. And I totally agree there's some people that are not good candidates for the surgery, and I don't operate on those people. I do not operate on someone that I think has unrealistic expectations or someone who has a problem that I don't think I can help. And I think it really falls to the profession, and it's not the fact that a person has plastic surgery. It's how the surgery is performed that depends on whether or not they emerge from the surgery with a natural look or whether they look like they've had plastic surgery. And we've seen this. I did part of my training there in Beverly Hills. And so as much as I learned what to do while I was there, I learned what not to do as well.
Yeah. Well, and what you're also alluding to, I think, is a little bit of psychiatric analysis or what's the other word? Anyway, looking into the psychology of the person.
You're because absolutely right.
We don't want a Michael Jackson.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and really, Michael's surgeon is at fault here, not for what he did necessarily, but for the fact that he didn't tell that young man, son, that's enough. We don't need to do anything else. And there are a lot of, I'm sorry to say, there are a lot of doctors in my profession that as long as you write them a big fat check, they'll operate on you. But I think we have to remember that we're doctors first, we're physicians first, we're surgeons second. And as a physician, you do no harm. And then there are people that come to see me, I would say on at least a weekly basis, that I refuse to operate on. And I tell them in a nice way that I just don't think that their expectations are realistic and that we really don't need to do the surgery. And I think we are bound by a code of ethics to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, like you said, with so many outlets knock on another door, and while four doors might be slammed on them, a fifth door will open. We see that in a lot of professions, not unique to your
profession. I've seen a lot of them come to me wanting to know what can be done to correct it. And quite frankly, not a lot until a few years pass, and then you can go back and readjust things. But, you know, as long as they're pulled stretched tight, there's not a lot you can do for that. And that's just unfortunate. We've seen people, all of us have seen people that were famous movie stars that had surgery and they don't even look like themselves, and it ruined their career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, well, we'll move on to heading toward talking about your new book coming out, among many that you have. I'm happy to talk about any of them that you've written, but I know the new one is coming out soon, Tomorrow in America, The Battle for the Souls of Our Children. But your background is so fascinating that I just want to talk a little bit more before we get into the details of the book, and your background in Alabama. So you, based on your bio, you appear to be Mr. Alabama, but starting with being part of the Paul Bear Bryant 1964 National Championship team and inducted into the State of Alabama Sports Hall of Fame in 2017, Distinguished Alabama Sportsman. Wow. Tell us about 1964.
Well, we had a great year that year. And, of course, we had a very, very talented quarterback by the name of Joe Namath. And so I was Joe Namath's center during the time that he played at Alabama. And Joe and I became good friends. He roomed across the hall from me. And he was from Pennsylvania. And he felt a little bit like a fish out of water coming down to the south. And I tried to make sure that he was as comfortable as he could be, and we tried to make sure he didn't decide to go home, because he really considered leaving Alabama the first semester he was there. It was during the civil rights movement, and he had some very strong feelings, and it just didn't fit in with some of the people there. And I tried to make sure that Joe adapted and did the very best that I could, and we remain friends to this day. But it was a good year. We went undefeated in the regular season and played Texas in the Orange Bowl. And you know, there are things that I tell people all the time. To win a championship, something good has to happen to you, and something bad has to happen to somebody else in order for you to move into the number one position. And so it was a wonderful thing. And I take those lessons with me that I learned from Coach Bryant. I take them with me every day into my practice. And I'm writing another book right now that's called The Saban Process, The Bryant Promise. And it shows, the book is trying to demonstrate that there are a lot of similarities between Coach Saban and Coach Bryant. And I say in the book that he doesn't look like Coach Bryant. Coach Saban doesn't walk like Coach Bryant. He doesn't talk like Coach Bryant. But between the ears, they're identical twins. They just call things a little different. But they teach the players not only how to perform on Saturdays, but they both focus on the game of life and how you can take those lessons that you learn in the sports arena and then apply them to your everyday business. And I do that every day. Not a day goes by that I don't think of some lesson that I learned from Coach Bryant as it applies to managing people in my clinic, my employees, or teaching. I've trained 100 facial plastic surgeons in my career. And so I use those lessons to train every one of those surgeons to go out and to try to do a good job for people.
Are you saying that Coach Bryant didn't just lead by example? He was actually trying to teach his players about things beyond the game of football?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, he would call a meeting sometimes at 5 o'clock in the morning. And the trainers would come around and wake us up, and we would go into the meeting room in another building, and he wouldn't even mention football. He would say, he said, I've been up all night thinking, and I just wanted to share something with you guys before we really got into our day's work. He said, you know, the day's going to come when you're going to think your world is falling apart. He said, you'll lose your job, and you go home, and you walk in the door, and you might find your wife there with another man. And said, your marriage will fall apart, and you just think, what am I going to do? And you, some of you are going to want to crawl into a hole. He said, that's not the way you do it. You pick up what you've got, and you go out and do whatever it takes to get your life back. And he talked to us all the time about preparing, rehearsing things. Never expect the unexpected, whether it's in football or whether it's in tennis or whether it's in plastic surgery. Always prepare for what you're going to do, expect the unexpected, and have a backup plan for whatever you do. And, you know, in the pregame talks that he gave to us, he did not do the rah-rah, win one for the Gipper. That was not at all. He calmed us down, and he would often say, you know that other team's going to come out. They're going to be all fired up, jumping up and down, slapping each other upside the helmet. And he said, you just stand there and watch that. And on that opening kickoff, you pick you out one of those, and you just run up there and you brat him right between those numbers and knock him on his back, and then reach down with your hand and help him up and say, I'll be right back. There's more of this to come. And so he just tried to calm us down and get us ready to go do our job and not go out there and be all hyped up and, you know, for a show.
Well, he certainly has a tremendous record as a coach. You could probably share with us how many national championships he won on the field. But it sounds to me as if you're saying there is a long list of very successful Alabama former Alabama players who played for Bryant and that used what they learned from him ultimately to be very successful in life.
Absolutely. It's well stated.
And it, you know, that's something that people don't pay attention to college football, probably don't think about it at all, but people who do just, you know, probably think that, you know, oh, these players aren't getting much of an education and they're being used and they're not getting paid for this, et cetera, and they're taking easy courses and so on. But at least in the terms of your experience and players who played for Coach Bryant, no, they were getting college plus, plus, plus.
Yeah, and the players that are playing for Coach Saban are getting the same thing. If you've watched an Alabama game, and sometimes the Alabama may be far ahead and put in many of the second and third stringers to go into the game, and one of them will make a stupid mistake, and Coach Saban will bring them to the sidelines and just really read them the riot act. And everybody said, why are you getting so excited? Because the game's already in the bag. But you have to understand what the Saban process is. The Saban process is that you do your very best every single time on every play, pay no attention to the scoreboard, and you're not competing against another player or another team. You're competing against yourself, and you are supposed to do the best you can do on every play, and you need to be prepared for that. You may not get in the game, or you may get in the game, but you be ready if you get the call to go in there and do your job, and that's the lesson he's teaching them when he brings them to the sideline, and you can bet the next week those players are going to pay more attention to everything that goes on in practice.
Mm-hmm. Tell me real quick before we move on to the book, and we'll hit the book after the break, I promise. But I'm still focused on Alabama in the 60s and your Namath story as far as the civil rights movement. Remind me, you know, when was Alabama as a university integrated and including the football team? And tell us about what your personal experience was.
While we were there, the university was integrated. It was 1963. And I remember we were on our way to the practice field, and we walked by what was the gymnasium, the basketball gymnasium. It wasn't the schoolhouse door. It was the door to the gymnasium that Governor Wallace stood in front of. And we saw what was going on there. But there were probably 100 people that were just gathered around, and we didn't pay much attention to it. We didn't even know what was going on. And then we saw Governor Wallace leave and go get in the limousine and drive off. And then we found out later that it was a big deal about a black woman, a young black woman, registering to become a classmate of ours. And for the players and the suitors that were there, this was no big deal. We weren't riding and we weren't trying to oppose anything. And this is something that a lot of people do not know. That whole episode, everything was scripted. George Wallace met with the FBI people beforehand, told them exactly what he was going to do. The minute that they said governor step aside, he did and went and left. So it was made, a lot more was made of it really than happened. It was just basically a non-event on the campus as far as we students were concerned. And we didn't know anything about it until we turn on the news and watch it in the afternoon or late afternoon or the 10 o'clock news. So it really was a non-event to the students. And, you know, and I think mm-hmm. history shows that both of the students that came through there, the first black students, were treated very, very nicely by the students. So anyway, it was the right thing to do. There's no question about that. Don't get me wrong. It was absolutely the right thing to do. And frankly, I'm glad I was there when it happened and witnessed it firsthand, because I saw what actually happened rather than what made stories that some people may be telling about it.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, this was what you're saying was mostly a stunt by the governor saying that I don't care what the Supreme Court may have ruled, et cetera. It's not happening here in Alabama. We're not going to integrate our schools here.
Well, George Wallace told me this personally, and that he had, it was a campaign promise. And he said, segregation now, segregation forever. And that was the campaign promise that he made, and he was elected on that. And so he said, this is something I had to do. He said, but, you know, I orchestrated it with the FBI and the U.S. Marshals. And he said they knew exactly what I was going to do. And that was confirmed by a gentleman who was president of one of the United Negro colleges from Dallas. And I was on an airplane talking with him one day coming back to Birmingham. And I said, what are you coming to Birmingham for? And he said, oh, we're having our meeting here, our national meeting here. And I said, I think that's wonderful. And he said, you'd never guess who our speaker is. And I said, no, sir, who is it? And he said, George Wallace. And I did the double take, and he said, let me tell you something, doctor. He said, George Wallace met with all of us black leaders long before he did this. And he told us, and I quote, George Wallace said, I can help you more by being against you than I could ever help you if I was for you, end quote. And he said, if you remember the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which is only second to the NCAA in members, gave George Wallace a Lifetime Achievement Award about 8 months before he died. There's a lot to the history that occurred here that I've written in my books. And in some of the books that, if we get around to talking to him today, all of this is addressed. And so it's a side of history that needs to be told. And and I think that the South has adapted very, very well to those changes. And I think if you were to live here, you would see that there's probably less racism in the South right now than there is in other parts of the country.
Yeah. All right, we're going to get to more of that after the break. I just want to read real quick from Wikipedia, because I looked it up while you were talking, just to let everybody know what you're talking about. The stand in the schoolhouse door, which is what it's called, took place at Foster Auditorium at the University of Alabama on June 11, 1963. George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, in a symbolic attempt to keep his inaugural promise of segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, and stop the desegregation of the schools, stood at the door of the auditorium as if to block the entry of two African-American students. We're going to keep talking fascinating with Dr. Galen McCullough after the break. You're listening to TNT Radio.
Silence for thinking differently? Silence for thinking differently? Not here. Silence for asking questions? Not here. Not here. Silence for discussing the other side of the story? Not on TNT Radio. Join the conversation anytime. Search TNT Radio on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Getter, or Gab. Download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk, TNT Radio.
My therapist had told me that I needed to go to AA meetings, but I wasn't sure whether I wanted to go because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. That was not what I wanted to grow up and be. I didn't want to go to AA, but I did, and it wasn't what I expected by any means. It was friendly. I could feel it. I mean, I could feel the happiness. It's really great.
Visit AA.org for more information and download the Meeting Guide app to find a meeting near you.
One in six Australian children are living in poverty. 8-year-old Anna doesn't have what she needs to keep up at school. With your help, children like Anna can access the learning support they need so they can build a better future. Search the Smith family and donate today.
One of the best things about Freedom Fest is while you can go to other places to talk about liberty and things like that, here you find a diverse group of people who will always teach you something new and make you think differently about the liberty movement.
There are all kinds of vendors here, all kinds of electeds. There are speakers, celebrities. We all have one thing in common. We think that there's too much government, and we think that our personal freedoms have eroded over time.
Don't miss Freedom Fest, the largest liberty event of the year. July 13th to 16th at the Mirage in Las Vegas. For more information, go to freedomfest.com.
The Great Reinfection. With thanks to the COVID vaccine, COVID vaccines are not safe and don't work. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone, to the James Breslow Show. We're speaking with Dr. Galen McCullough, author of many books, including his upcoming book, Tomorrow in America, The Battle for the Soul of Our Children, Souls of Our Children. I want to stay just for a second on the South and what you said is some misconceptions that people have about the South. I mean, what you mentioned that it's far less racist than people think it is. I mean, how would you describe the current state of racial affairs in Alabama?
I think people would be surprised at how little animosity and division there is. If you look at Birmingham, Alabama, for example, where I lived for 35 years, and then I moved to the Gulf Coast, Gulf Shores, Alabama, 21 years ago, I would say 90% of City Hall was black when I was living there, the mayor and the commissioners and the employees. So there was absolutely no issue with that, and I had multiple interactions. I was part of the Chamber of Commerce, Big Brothers, Big Sisters. I was actively involved in city affairs, and there was no issue at all with all of that. And if you look at the Alabama Sports Hall of Fame, you'll find that there are as many, if not more, black athletes that are inducted into the Alabama Sports Hall of Fame, which I was president of for a number of years, than there are white players. And certainly if you look at the football teams are probably 80 or 90% black in the South. And if you look up in the Northwest, Wisconsin, the Dakotas, some of the places up there, you see an occasional black player. So most of the players up there are white. And so we have about a 50-50 mix between whites and blacks in the South. And I think we get along very well. It's not as big of a deal until you turn on the radio or turn on the news, the lamestream news. I like to call them the Big Brother news, because they are really an example of what an Orwellian America is like. They're trying to control the narrative. And so I just think people would be really pleasantly surprised if they came here and spent any time in the South.
Yeah. Yeah, of course it's all overblown. That the left is trying to divide us based on race. They don't want to let go of this issue, even though we're in pretty much a post-racial world. Mixed race is everywhere. Barack Obama was our president, but they just won't let it go. And they this George Floyd thing, they're trying to turn into something obviously far, 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 far bigger than it is. And one thing that I point out is that at the height of the George Floyd thing, the whole issue of race and black and white, I mean, it's just not something that's in my conscious and in most people's conscious. But man, when they put it out there and constantly that's all they talk about, all of a sudden, when a black person comes on the elevator with me, I'm now thinking, oh, black person. I never thought of it before. But if you're going to constantly identify somebody based on their race and be putting that in my head 24/7, then yeah, I am going to start thinking of people based on their race, which is so ridiculous to begin with, since we're all the human race.
That's by design, James. You hit it on the nail, hit the nail on the head, I should say. That's all by design. There's an all-out attempt, an agenda to divide America in every way possible. We've talked about dividing us by race, but they're also dividing us by religion and dividing us by gender and dividing us by income in any way that they possibly can, because the old adage, divide and conquer, is as accurate as today as it was 100 to 200 or 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. And so people just have to realize, when you listen to the news, that there is something, there is an agenda there. I've often said, if somebody said, "What if you could take any position in the world and have it, what would it be?" And I would say the ability to edit the news, because you can take whatever is out there and decide we're going to focus on this story, or we're not going to focus on it. We can take a positive, or we can take a negative approach to it. So the power to edit is something that people don't realize, and it is an extremely dangerous power. Power is not neutral. So anybody that says they want to get into power in order to make things okay. And this world today doesn't seem to be their agenda. They're there to make changes, and changes sometimes can be positive and sometimes they can be negative. And we're witnessing a lot of changes right now. We're seeing a return to Obama's years, with Biden. And it's just a way to do everything they can to prepare us for what I think is a one-world government. And people will say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. Well, you know, a theory is something that might happen. But when you start seeing these things unfold in front of you, it's no longer a theory. It's a reality. And people don't realize that actually the United Nations already has a manifesto, a document. They set up a committee about 20 years ago to develop a committee on to develop the agenda on how to establish a one-world government. And it says a one-world currency, a one-world army, a one-world judicial system, and that's the plan. It's all heading toward a one-world government, and that will never happen as long as there's a good and great and strong United States of America. And so if they are to get their one-world government, they have to take America down. And you can look around and see that we're being divided and weakened and going further in debt. And keep in mind, you know, what Amschel Rothschild said some 300 years ago, give me the ability to control a nation's currency, and I care not who makes the laws. And so who controls America's currency? Many people think that it's a federal bank. No, it's a private bank with a federal name. And the board of directors of the Federal Reserve are controlling the money in America. They can decide when interest rates go up, when they go down. And by doing that, they can either put the economy on halt, or they can pick it up again. And what have they just done within the last week or so? The greatest rise in interest rates, I think, in the last 20 or 30 years, if I'm not mistaken, since maybe even longer than that, I think since Jimmy Carter was in office. So if you start paying attention to the news and saying, what's the agenda behind this? And in one of my books, I tell the story about being invited to the National Defense University with a group of civilians. And there were two colonels that came in and started telling us about all the regime changes that were going on in the world. And we didn't have name tags on. I had to go through an FBI clearance in order to go to this event. And so when they said, any questions, my hand was the first one up, of course. And they said, Dr. McCullough, what's your question? And I thought, how in the world do they know who I am? And I said, why would you bring a group of civilians here and tell us these things? And they kind of smiled and said, Doctor, we want to see what you think you know. Did any of you know about these events that we've just told you about? And everybody in the room shook their head, no. And they said, what you read and what you hear in the news, there's some truth to it. They said, we know our enemies. Read our newspapers, read our magazines, and watch our news. And we're not about to tell everything. And so just pay attention to that. And ever since that day, that was affirmed to me by the people in the military, high-level military, and security of our country, that they do not reveal everything that happens. So, you know, the Big Brother News can take anything that they want and spin it into a narrative. And that narrative then is picked up all around the country and then repeated in their circles.
Mm-hmm. So you believe the biggest threat to America is those that are looking toward a one-world government?
I do. I really do. And let me pick up on exactly that, plus the fact that we're being divided. One of my books that is part of this three-book series is called When Patriots Rally. And the subtitle of that is America's Greatest Weapon Against Our Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. Now, that title came from a meeting that I had with a communist doctor about 25 years ago. We were in a meeting in West Germany, and he was there, and I was interested in knowing what was it like in a communist country to practice medicine. It took me about two days before he warmed up to me and trusted that I wasn't somebody trying to get him in trouble. And I asked him a question. This was in the height of the Cold War. And I said, Doctor, tell me, what is it that Russia respects most or fears most about the United States of America? He never hesitated. He said, your ability to rally when your backs are against the wall. Now, take that. If that's what our enemies fear most from us or about us, how do they weaken us? They make it impossible for us to come together and rally. And they do that by dividing us in every way possible. And that's the entire theme of the other book. It's a three-part series. It's called When Patriots Rally, America's Greatest Weapon Against Our Enemies, Foreign and Domestic.
Yeah, if we all share in a common love and belief in the founding of our country and the founding principles and the founding fathers and the founding documents, it makes us very strong. If we don't share that common belief, we don't have much else. We just happen to live in the same geographic area, but that's about it.
Well, think about if you're old enough to remember the movies that came out during World War II. All of the movies were pro-American. All the movies showed our soldiers, our men and women in uniform as heroes and doing great things and America doing things for the right reason. And what about movies that are made today? Do they really feature the best of America, or do our movies that we're seeing today feature the very worst of America? I can tell you that we try to find things to watch at night and on the weekends, and it's very difficult to find a pro-American movie, one that teaches godly principles and patriotic principles. You can find the other message just filtered all throughout the entertainment industry, whether it's movies or television or music. I mean, the music that is out there today would just absolutely turn your stomach if you listen to some of the words. And so we've lost our focus on being a godly America. And when we lose our focus on being a good America, we're in deep trouble. In one of the books, I talk about Alex de Tocqueville. Many people don't know, but he was a French historian that about 100 years after America had been founded, he came to America and he wanted to find out why America had come so far in such a short period of time as a democracy. And he went around the country and he went to our ports and he went to the bread belt, our farm belt. He went to the industrial centers. He went all around, and finally he went into our churches. And he wrote in his book that America is great because America is good. If America ever ceases being good, it will no longer be great. Now, that book was written about 150 years ago. And so, once again, if you're the enemy of America and you see all of these things and it becomes a weapon, what are you going to do? And we are so naive as a country right now that we just are allowing these things to happen around us. And anybody that points it out is called a conspiracy theorist. But as I said, a theory is something that might happen. When you look around and see it actually happening, it's no longer a theory.
Yeah, it's very scary how far they've come. You were talking about movies. My prior guest, we were talking about Woke Hollywood, and Top Gun came up. I don't know if you've seen the movie yet, but you know, the conservative media is hailing it as demonstrating that, you know, return, and this is what people want, and you know, is patriotism and so on. That movie, have you seen it by chance, Galen?
Say it again. What's the movie?
Have you seen the new Top Gun movie with Tom Cruise?
Oh yes, yes I have. Yes I have, and I really was not excited about going to see it. I really wasn't. And I got there, and when I left that movie, I said, wow, I'm so glad I saw this. It was good entertainment. It was wholesome entertainment. It was pro-American entertainment. It featured our fighting men and women. I mean, that's the kind of thing. And look at what it's doing in the box office. It is burying all of the other trash that's out there. But Hollywood won't get that message because they're being funded by very, very deep pockets. They're being managed by very, very deep pockets to propagate the other side of that message.
Yeah. Oh, and it's clearly winning big time. Tell us, you mentioned they quite a bit. So define they.
Okay. And this here's where the conspiracy theory thing comes in. I have been researching this for the better part of 25 years, And there is a group of very, very wealthy people who gather in Davos, Switzerland every year. And they sit around these tables for 2 or 3 days and they decide what's going to happen in the world. And these are world bankers and what's called an intellectual elite. Well, many people thought that that was a theory for a long time. And then lo and behold, somebody recorded one of the meetings and at a trilateral commission meeting. And David Rockefeller said, and I think I can quote it pretty accurately, "We want to thank the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Time Magazine for their discretion over the years, because we would not have been able to create what we have done without their assistance." And that is, America and the world is prepared for a one world government, a group of world bankers and intellectual elite. And so this whole quote is in every one of my books. And you can Google David Rockefeller Trilateral Commission and you can read the whole thing. And so he revealed exactly their plan. And so it's not a theory. And then you look at exactly what happened a year later, the United Nations created their commission on world government. And so to sit around and say that this is a theory, we're being foolish. We're being naive. And it's happening. And the people who control the Federal Reserve, the world bankers, and the International Monetary Fund, all of those individuals are very, very powerful. And they do not love America. You look at George Soros. He's not a member. He's trying to evil his way into the group, the 13 powerful families. But he's not a member right now. And if you really knew his history, his real name was Georgie Schwartz. And he was a Jewish man in World War II who left the Jewish community and sided with the Nazis. And he would turn in the Nazi families. And then the Nazi soldiers would go there and then clean their house out and take all the family. And George Soros' deal was he got to keep the silver and the art and all of those things that were taken out of that house. And that's how he made his first million. And then he's done some other things in England, trying to corner the market in England, and was very successful with that. But George Soros is funding many of these organizations that create havoc in our streets. And so, yeah, there are people that are doing it. All you got to do is follow the money. It's pretty simple. It's an old adage.
We got to take a break, but I'm glad you brought up George Soros because I do want to ask you some more questions about what is really motivating this guy. I'm dying to hear your response to that. We'll be back with more with Dr. Galen McCullough on TNT Radio.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
The latest research by Redfield and Wilton Strategies, released on the 17th of June, finds that the economy is on the top of mind for midterm voters. The survey asks respondents which issues are most likely to determine how you vote in the November midterm election. Respondents were asked to select their top three issues, and the economy topped the list, with 61% identifying it as a top issue. No other issues were close. Healthcare arrived at a distant second, with 31% placing it among the top issues. Abortion hit third at 27%, followed by immigration at 22%. It's notable that foreign policy and defence only came in at 10%. Because the United States' economic woes, to a large extent, have been a product of the military-industrial complex and disastrous foreign interventions. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
Emergency, police, fire, ambulance.
Hello?
Yes, police, fire, or ambulance.
It's my friend.
Oh, okay, look, I need you to stay on the phone. Just stay on the phone.
You're
okay, now hang on. Oh.
000's sole job is to connect you to emergency services. So please, stay on the line and you'll get help faster.
Mums, dads and grandparents, did you know that each year close to 1,000 Australian and New Zealand children experience a burn injury that requires treatment at a specialist burns unit? 79% of these burns happen in the home, and all of them can be prevented. June is KidSafe's National Burns Awareness Month. as there's a significant increased risk of burns during the winter. Visit kidsafe.com.au to download the free burn safety checklist and get some essential tips for keeping kids safe in your home.
For the news and talk you can't hear anywhere else, it's TNT Radio.
And we are back on the James Breslow Show. We're talking to our guest, Dr. Galen McCullough, MD, plastic surgeon, member of the Bear Bryant's 1964 National Championship football team and part of the Alabama Sports Hall of Fame. Let's just go back and hit on Soros before I want to hit one more subject before we're done. We only got about 10 minutes. But what is motivating Soros? What does he want? Big picture.
Power. As a matter of fact, a few years ago, Steve Croft, one of the 60 Minutes hosts, interviewed George Soros. And during that interview, you can watch that too. This is something that's out there, public knowledge. Steve Croft brought up the fact that George Soros turned upon his fellow Jews and sided with the Nazis. And he asked him, he said, "Do you have any remorse about what you did?" And he said, "No, none." And he said, "Well, how did you feel after you did that?" And he said, "Power, sheer power, absolute power." I mean, that just reeks of evil in every way possible. And so George Soros is, as I said, I think he's trying to evil his way into being a part of the Big 13 families that have controlled the world for a long, long time. So that's my take on Soros. And if you look around, you'll see that he actually is funding a lot of the movements, Black Lives Matter.
We covered
other,
that in the...
Many of the other things, yeah. he's behind it.
Yeah, and good point. He's funded Black Lives Matter, Antifa, and all these district attorneys. What is he trying to achieve?
He also contributes to the prosecutors, the attorneys general, in almost every state. He picks the most liberal one that he can find, the candidate he can find, and pours money into their campaign. So he's literally, I think he's trying to destroy America. I mean, why would he be doing a lot of these things if not? And what really saddens me is that many of the black people who are falling for what I call this big lie are going to find out that when we go down, everybody goes down. And they're not going to be any favorites at that time. Because these people that are at absolute power, they intend to enslave us all.
So, yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me that he's looking for the downfall of America. If you look at any of the things that he funds in the U.S., they're all things to divide us and make our society crumble. These terrible DAs
he's an agent of destruction.
Criminals out on the streets. But you're saying also he's attempting to join. You're saying he's trying to join the 13 families in Davos. So are you saying that they share the same desire to see America crumble?
But they're not as ruthless, is it? I said this earlier. You got to keep this in mind, your listeners too, that in order to create a one world government, you have to take the United States down and make it a puppet state. Because as long as there's a strong United States, and as long as the United States and Australia stick together, and Israel, and perhaps England, as long as we have those countries, many of them, including Australia, from what I learned from my friends there, is becoming more socialistic by the day. And so, really, America is the nugget. We're the golden egg, so to speak. And if they can take America down, then the others will fall like dominoes.
Let me throw a curveball at you in our final minutes, because this is something that I ruminate over and conflicted about. And so a man of the South such as you, with a long history there, is a great person to ask this question. We see Confederate statues being taken down in so many places. And, it's part of our history and part of the South's history in particular. But, the Confederates did attempt to defend slavery and lost. And so, you know, I could certainly see an argument. Why should we be having monuments to these generals from the South who were defending slavery? What is your take? What should we think about Confederate statues coming down?
Well, I would say that the it's called the Civil War, but it really is the war between the states. There was nothing civil about that war when you look at the amount of carnage on both sides that occurred from it. But I would say that to erect a statue today to a Confederate general would be a mistake. But that's part of our history, and it's part of how America went through very difficult times. And we were a divided nation as much as you could ever think about dividing a nation. And yet, following that war, we came back together again, and we created the greatest country in the history of planet Earth following that Civil War. And people from the North, people from the South, East and West, all came together and became Americans. And Lincoln recognized this. And in some of my books, I quote Lincoln's comments about the fact that he was concerned as to whether or not we could stay together. And I think that it's a mistake to rewrite history. That's the only thing I'm concerned about, because if you look in George Orwell's book 1984, and I wrote the only sequel to that book that's ever been written, called Orwell's America, rewriting history is a way to change a country, because the people who control history control the future. Just as George Orwell said, people who control the present control the past, and people who control the past control the future. And so it is a part of our history. It's a dark part of our history, and let's recognize it as that, but let's learn from it. Rather than destroy it, let's learn from it and move on. And so I'm opposed to destroying any statue. Now, let's say that 150 years from now, somebody destroys Martin Luther King's statue. It would be absolutely wrong to do that because they didn't agree with him. But if we start this, then it's going to just escalate. It's going to be a domino principle. And I really thank President Trump for putting a stop to it by imposing very strict penalties upon people who were caught destroying any statue whatsoever.
Yeah, well, you make a good point about the slippery slope, because it did end up impacting. I think there was just a Lincoln statue that just went down. And you make a great point about Martin Luther King, because judging people based on the content of their character rather than the color of their skin, that's not what the left tells us to do. They tell us absolutely positively you need to judge people based on the color of their skin, not on the content of their character, because you need to have X number of black and brown people on your board of directors or in your movie or in your business or in your university or among your teachers, etc. So it's absolutely opposite of what Martin Luther King said, and therefore they should start tearing down, or may in fact start tearing down, MLK statues soon, based on their logic.
Well, yeah, I think it's disrespectful of Martin Luther King for the left to be promoting that, because they are in effect spitting in his face by not following of the things that so many people fought for. And we talked about the Stand in the Schoolhouse Door, all of those things people fought for and against, just like in the Civil War. But when it was over, it's over. And we need to move on and not go back and try to rewrite history and create it in a way that we think it should have happened and destroy the truth. Because George Orwell's book, if you haven't read it, and it used to be required reading in schools, but obviously that was nixed a few years ago. But it's exactly the type of dystopian society that Orwell described, and you can look around and see that we are very, very close to being there right now. Big Brother, looking at everything, being able to track us where we go, what we do, what we watch on everything we go to Google and download, all of that's being collected, and we're being profiled, and vaccinated, unvaccinated, all of those kinds of things. It's just it's so obvious where we're heading, and the fact that people are trying to divide us. And we need to do what the title of my upcoming book says: we need to rally. We need to all come together and put aside our differences and make sure that we absolutely demand free and fair elections, because when our election process goes south and we can no longer depend on that, we've become a third world country. And so I really hope that the upcoming election and November, that the people will rally and demand that it election integrity and that we have a free and fair election. Because if we don't do that, then we're Venezuela or Cuba, or we become some of the countries that we don't like. So I just am concerned.
Dr. Galen McCullough. There's
a very short opportunity.
We got
for us to study America.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time. Loved connecting with you. Check out his book, Tomorrow in America, and also go to McCulloughInstitute.com. Thank you to Dr. Galen McCullough. Love to have you on again soon. You're listening to The James Breslow Show on TNT Radio.